Structure is your friend. What you've just heard was a snippet of Linda Clark and Natalie Wilde performing the end of my short play Waiting for Go in the British Theatre Challenge 2017. My name is Elspeth Tilley and I teach theatre and creative communication in the School of English and Media Studies at Massey University. I'm also a playwright and I'm going to talk to you about structure in playwriting, and I'm calling this podcast Structure is Your Friend. Many long years ago, when I did my first ever playwriting course in Brisbane, Australia, we had a wonderful teacher, the award-winning playwright Hilary Beaton. Hilary was patient and skillful, and she coached us in everything we would ever need to know how to write plays. And everything that Hilary said, I thought was wrong. I was probably the worst student she ever encountered. She was teaching us about three-act structure, the need for a clear beginning, middle, and end, and I rebelled. It sounded so simplistic to my 20-year-old self. Playwriting is creative, I thought. It should be novel, original, confronting the audience with larger-than-life ideas. And why would you want to shove your outsized creativity into small, defined boxes? You should be able to throw anything anywhere and splash your creativity around randomly, I thought. Paint on a big canvas and dazzle the audience. It took me a lot of years to figure it out, but boy was I wrong. And boy was Hilary and every other skillful, patient teacher of creativity in any form who tells you structure is your friend, right. Having structure helps, not hinders, your creativity. These days I teach on a course at Massey University called Creative Processes. We get in a lot of guest speakers from different creative disciplines, and without exception, they tell the classes a variation on the theme of structure is your friend. The award-winning Wellington poet John Denison, for example, talked about how using sonnet structure took his poetry to a whole new level. Not less creative, more creative because of the rules. When the structure provided a container for his material, he could stop putting all his energy into thinking about the big picture, and somehow that released him to focus more on the ideas themselves, and he found that the words and images within that structure were soaring to new heights. Musician James Vandermas talked about having writer's block when composing new songs and lyrics, and said going back to structure, in his case to a pentatonic scale structure that gives certain limitations for composers, actually broke him through his songwriting block. Novelists that I know find it helps to warm up by writing 100-word stories, not a word more, not a word less. So structure provides a sort of touch point or launching pad for creativity. In my own work writing 10-minute plays, these days I have the benefit of being able to enter competitions in order to find out very quickly which plays are working for directors and audiences and which ones aren't. And without exception, the plays with a solid structure get picked up for production, and the plays without just don't. I don't think this means that the plays that get picked up are predictable or formulaic, because I think the ideas in them are still different and original, but it does mean that they're recognisable as narratives. And human beings have a very deep and embedded relationship to narrative forms. Neuroscientists have even found that when we retell random events, we overlay a narrative structure with beginning, middle, and end. It's how we make sense of our world. So if you want audiences to make sense of the world of your play, a narrative fits with their sense-making needs. Partly, I think it's also about not doing too much in one piece of creative work. I often want to put quite weird, confronting and unusual subject matter in a play, like horses that talk, or a hospital that turns into a reality TV show. I think it would be too much going on at once if the play had a confronting subject and a confronting structure. But if the structure has coherence, then the material seems to be able to get away with being a bit more unconventional. Aristotle said that the beginning supposes nothing wanting before itself and requires something after it. The middle supposes something that went before and requires something to follow after. The end requires nothing after itself, but supposes something that goes before. In other words, everything leads inexorably up to the end point. And because everything leads to the end point, a playwriting tip I find really useful is to actually work backwards from the end when you're writing. Especially for the 10-minute play, which is a specific genre all of its own, having an end reveal the logic that then makes the whole play make sense is really useful. A revelation at the end rewards the audience, sort of like a detective story. So if you want the beginning and middle to serve the end, it doesn't hurt to actually write the end first. So, for example, in Waiting for Go, that you heard a snippet from, the end, spoiler alert, sorry, reveals that the roadworkers that have been holding up traffic have been deceiving the motorists the whole time. They're actually doing it on purpose. So it's the punchline, and I knew it was where the story was heading before I started writing. So I wrote that end part first as the goal of the narrative. And working backwards from that, the middle is a bit where we're getting to know the characters and understand their world, which in turn will make the ending make sense. If we know where we're going, then the middle can stay tight and it helps us figure out which is the crucial detail. And then working backwards from that, you put your hook at the beginning, something to grab attention. So in that particular one, because 10-minute plays are renowned for their frenetic pace as they try and meet the 10-minute requirement, I thought, well, what about a beginning where nothing happens? In a show of really fast-paced openings, that would be something different and attention-grabbing just by virtue of being different. So in the beginning of that play, nothing happens for almost an entire minute, which is a very long time on stage. And people start laughing just because nothing's happening. It's channeling Beckett's Waiting for Godot, but it's also deliberately subverting the convention of the manic 10-minute play. In Bunnies and Wolves, which won the British Theatre Challenge in 2018, the kicker I had at the end is that revelation that the whole play has actually been a reality TV show. And again, the middle develops characters and world, and the beginning, this time diving right into the 10-minute play tradition of fast pace, has a critically ill child raced across the stage in a hospital bed by a team of doctors shouting jargon. So it grabs you in, the stakes are instantly high, and then the world and the characters build from there. But it's always heading towards the end, which was written first. Another one that has a sort of a revelation at the end is Fabio the Great, which won the Westcliff Colorado Center for the Arts 10-minute play competition in 2018. The end reveal there is that one of the characters has lied to another character, which is a classic dramatic tension device. The middle gets us up close and personal with those characters, so we care when we discover a lie, and the beginning has a bunch of racehorses come on stage. So again, it's that three-act structure: hook, development, complication, and finally resolution, revelation at the end. It's just like Aristotle said, except I wrote it backwards and then put it together forwards. If it sounds like there's a sort of predictable familiarity about the three-act structure of these plays, does it help if I tell you that Waiting for Go is actually about climate change, Bunnies and Wolves is actually about the risks of privatisation in the health sector, and Fabio the Great is actually about toxic masculinity and animal rights both? So these are some really big and definitely not formulaic topics. If I told you to go see a play about privatisation in the health sector, I'm not sure you'd be that interested. But if you heard there's a story about three racehorses who team up to trick their trainers into letting one of them escape, maybe it sounds a little bit more like something you would go to the theatre to see. So the story provides the container that lets me sneak in the politics. The narrative structure is my Trojan horse. If it's what I have to do to get people watching plays about toxic masculinity, and that's really my goal in the end, then that's fine. So structure is my means to an end. And it works. When I depart from it and churn out some long stream of political consciousness, which I do every now and then, nobody wants to produce it. the point of a play is to get it on stage. So in light of that, I'm finally okay with everything Hilary Beaton said. She was right, and structure is my friend. I have to add a postscript, though. For every rule, there is an exception, and I want to draw your attention to an absolutely fantastic article by the founder of Climate Change Theatre Action, Chantal Bilodeau. It's called Why I'm Breaking Up with Aristotle. You can find it on HowlRound Theatre Commons. Chantal lists all the reasons why we should actually be working towards moving away from Aristotelian structure, and they are all very good reasons. It's well worth a read. For now, though, if having solid structure means I can get a play about climate change or toxic masculinity on stage, then that's what I'll do. So happy New Zealand Theatre Month, and please be sure to check out the rest of our playwriting podcast.